Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and environmental science and policy, which takes in a whole lot of things that are really active and critical in our world today. I've been in the media for several decades. I'm also a media critic and constantly informing people about what is and what is not covered in the press. And on today's show, I'm really thrilled to have with me someone who is the editor of a website that basically focuses just on that. My guest today is Jim Narekis, who's the editor of FAIR.org. That's Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting is their website. And he's done a whole bunch of different other things. He's worked as an investigative reporter for the newspaper In These Times, where he covered the Iran-Contra scandal. And he's just done a whole lot of really interesting things. And I follow FAIR regularly. Their articles are really terrific for looking at the media's distortions and partialities and outright corruption that enters in. And I think at no prior point in time have more people become more aware of the fact that the lens through which we look at how we are doing, the state of our democracy, the candidates, the election, our participation as citizens, and, you know, how we go forward as, you know, in a democracy, is reliant upon a fair and accurate media. I think people have never been so aware of the problem as they are now. And so I'm really delighted to have Jim Narekis joining me on today's show. Welcome, Jim, to Connect the Dots.
Thanks for having me on.
So, you know, just for starters, before we sort of dive into the role of the media in general and, in, you know, and how it's devolving and how that affects the current election cycle and all of the critical issues that we're looking at, tell our listeners just a little bit about how fairness and accuracy in reporting came about and what your sort of signature focus is.
Well, we've been around for 30 years. We're celebrating our 30th anniversary, we came up in the Reagan era, which was a time when the country was moving to the right in a fairly dramatic way, and there was the media played a big role in that, in kind of rewriting reality to match the official narrative, which had shifted in a very conservative direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so you saw a lot of real kind of fantastic coverage in media where people who were committing terrorists became freedom fighters and people who were, exposing the country to toxic pollutions were people who were growing the economy and so on. On issue after issue, things were being reframed. The folks who founded FAIR, Jeff Cohen and others, saw a need to have a organization that spoke out against the rewriting of reality, and that provided something that the corporate media have never really done, which is a voice for activist movements, people trying to change things in a progressive direction. They have always had a difficult time getting coverage in a press that is dominated by for-profit corporations. In the 80s, those were becoming larger and larger, and funded by advertising. And it's FAIR's basic position that the structure of media, the ownership of media, the funding of media, places real limitations on what media are able to talk about. If you have you know, multinational corporations owning your news outlets, you're not going to see fundamental questioning of the economic system that has made those multinational corporations very wealthy. And so we are dedicated to calling attention to the boundaries and the sort of inherent slant that you see in day-to-day news coverage, to calling out individual stories that are particularly distorted, but really want to make people aware of the fact that their news does come from a point of view, and it's the point of view of the people who own the news. It's not the point of view of the people who read the news.
Mm-hmm.
And to make people aware of the need both to be critical readers, because, you know, the media are, they do play an essential role in our society, despite their kind of warped nature. So, you know, I don't think ignoring the news is really a feasible solution, but you need to read it critically, and you need to seek out independent news outlets, like WPRN, to find alternative sources of news that don't have the same restrictions on what they can talk about and how.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's incredibly critical. And also, you know, with the recent WikiLeaks, we need the perspective of journalists and reporters on their value, the role they play, you know, a kind of unpacking of the content contained therein. You know, otherwise it's, you know, with the rise of public relations folks, you know, there's many more public relations people than there are media. Back in the day, it used to be that, you know, there were more journalists, and then the PR folks were kind of knocking on your door trying to get you to cover some of their interests and stories. And now they've really taken over, and it's, you know, media is both, you know, has to be both on the offensive with original reporting and also on the defensive to debunk the talking points, the industry statements, you know, that come through as ideas. And I think one of the, for me, being in the media and having gone through the exact shift that you've you know, that you've described, you know, from, you know, over the time, because Reagan is really the very first one where they really began re-spinning things and targeting reporters and cutting down funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and PBS and eventually NPR. So even trusted liberal outlets, for example, those or the New York Times, are no longer as trustworthy. You know, when did you see the kind of the shift happening, or, you know, what would you describe as being the kind of, you know, a key benchmark in when you noticed the shift?
Well, you know, I came of age in the 80s, mm-hmm. and my first job in journalism was at a paper called In These Times out of Chicago, mm-hmm. Which was a progressive newsweekly at that point, that was trying to cover the news from an independent, kind of labor-oriented, progressive-oriented, though our boss would never let us use the word progressive. He didn't mm-hmm. like it. I was an intern there, and I was hired on staff to cover the Iran-Contra scandal, because it was such a complicated scandal that there's really no way to sort it out unless you were working out full time. And I was, you know, a cub reporter. I'd, you know, done some opinion writing in college, but had no formal journalistic training. I was reporting out of a windowless room in Chicago. I was able to find stories that were not being covered. And Iran-Contra at that point was a big story. It was the huge story of the day. And, you know, reporters were swarming on it. And the fact that people who were much more experienced than I, and in some cases smarter than I was, were not able to get the same stories when they were, you know, right there in Washington, made me realize there was something wrong with the media system. that I should not be able to. There shouldn't have been no news for me to pick up. And you could see in the way that that people didn't follow the stories to their logical conclusion. And a big part of it was that Iran-Contra was not a rogue operation run out of the White House basement. It was integrated into the foreign policy apparatus of the United States with, you know, people from the State Department, the Defense Department, the CIA all working together to do this illegal policy that the president had decided that he was going to carry out. And that was really the main story that media did not want to tell. They wanted to tell a story of some oddballs who had gone off on their own and done these crazy stunts, while the grown-ups in Washington, you know, the George Shultzes and the Cap Weinbergers, were left out of the loop. In George Bush Sr.'s famous phrase, and George Bush Sr. was there's a memo that came out during the Iran-Contra investigation, where his national security advisor, he was vice president at the time, his national security advisor gave him a memo saying that he was going to talk to one of the main people in the illegal operation to fund the Contras, who were terrorists trying to overthrow the government of Nicaragua. And Congress had forbidden the government from funding them. One of the people who was illegally shipping arms to them from El Salvador was going to meet with George Bush, and according to the memos, it was going to talk about resupply of the Contras. So this is the smoking gun that showed that the vice president was briefed on this illegal operation that he claimed to know nothing about, and the media just ignored that memo. You know, and particularly in the 88 election campaign, which happened shortly thereafter, where you would think, as the vice president is becoming the president of the United States, you'd think there would be attention paid to the fact that he was implicated in the biggest scandal of the administration that he was vice president of. But it really had gone down the memory hole. And that was really, things like this were a real education to me. This is my sort of on the streets education in journalism, was seeing how the boundaries for what you could talk about and what you couldn't talk about were very clear, even though no one talked about them, because you can't talk about what you can't talk about. But everyone knew what you couldn't talk about.
What do you this whole sense of, like, so in other words, what you're saying is, if you kind of work for an outfit and you want to keep your job, you kind of absorb certain unspoken givens. It may not be laid out anywhere in a memo where we could get someone to hand the memo over and prove it. It might be a little here and a little there written about in strategies or emails or exchanges of some kind or another, such as we've, had uncovered through the WikiLeaks Podesta emails. But basically, this is a sense of what we do, what we don't do, whom we help, who we don't help, what we cover, what we don't cover, that people absorb and kind of, journalists absorb if they want to keep their jobs. I mean, actually, I remember I was at CBS News at one point, and this is kind of an ironic and sort of more historic today, but this is back in 1992. I was friends with some people who were leading groups to They were Native Americans helping lead groups for other Native Americans in addressing issues of addiction, which certainly, you know, have grown more widespread in the overall population today. And they had developed ways of using, you know, community and ceremony and all the things we're seeing at the, you know, the uprising against the Dakota Access Pipeline today. They were using them, you know, to kind of help their population of people move toward health and away from addiction. I proposed this to several nightly news magazine shows because that's what I was working on, for whom I was working at the time at CBS National. And I was told, you know, someone pulled me aside and said, oh, we never cover Native Americans, just for you to know, because they they speak too slowly. And and, you know, so today we're seeing this, you know, basically an exclusion of coverage, a blackout of coverage, finally moving into coverage because a celebrity, you know, like Mark Ruffalo, who's, you know, been a terrific environmental leader, comes to Standing Rock where this uprising is occurring. And then, you know, we have CNN and MSNBC are suddenly covering this thing, which is all over social media. You know, it's all over Facebook. Many people are thrilled to be hearing the reports of slow-speaking, and they're not so slow-speaking Native right. Americans with their grounded earth wisdom and connection and stuff like that. While
the
mainstream
media is a force unto itself, and it meshes in many ways with the official narrative that media are expected to promote, and I think it also relates to the fact that advertisers are overwhelmingly the supply of funding for media,
mm-hmm.
because advertisers the basic pitch of advertising is to create an in-group that you want to be in if you buy the product and not be in the out-group. And creating a racial identity is very helpful in selling. You want to say, you know, if you're one of us, which is often ethnically defined, then you buy the thing that we're telling you to buy. And so there's a real push to have a homogenous market that you can that advertisers can offer their products to, and a need to differentiate your shows by the ethnic target audience, and I think it comes into a lot of the a lot of news coverage where they fall naturally into these us versus them narratives. And I think this has a lot to do with why, for example, terrorism is always defined in corporate media as Islamic violence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult if a white Christian American massacres people and says he did it because of his right-wing politics. It's very difficult to get the media to call that terrorism because terrorism is this way of telling us, white America, that they, you know, outsiders who are, you know, religiously defined in this case, are a threat to us. You know, when you think of immigration, the immigration issue is always presented in terms of Latin Americans coming into the United States. Many, many people without the correct visas in the United States are from Europe. But that's never talked when people talk about illegal immigration. They're not talking about that because they're talking about psychologically influx of non-white people into what is portrayed as a white nation. And that's also that us versus them kind of attitude that advertisers feed on and media feeds on. And I think that when you're talking about Standing Rock, it's much easier to get media to cover it if you can present a white celebrity as a figurehead.
Mm-hmm.
To you know, because it's believed, I think completely misreading human nature, believe that people cannot identify cross a cultural boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need a white person to stand in for the viewer and be like, hey, this is bad. instead of having the slow talking Indians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's very, very accurate. I mean, there is this sense of if we can't get a celebrity, then we're invisible. You know, the issue is invisible, we're invisible, and, you know, I've covered fracking from the time that it was completely unknown. The trade deals, I've covered this horrible gas pipeline through the nuclear power plant at Indian Point in New York, which threatens the lives of 20 million New Yorkers. And surprise, surprise, you know, the TPP covers 65% or upward, not that agreement alone, but these series of agreements would cover the global, you know, GDP, and the New York Times doesn't cover it. So we have something very selective going on in the media. You know, one idea that I love in what you said that I wanted to pick up on is that the idea of homogenizing an audience so that you can have one big brand for your product. How has that played out in the current election in terms of the two candidates? Because that is something, you know, that we see where we have this deep polarization in terms of, you know, which camp people are in. The Clinton camp is really defined as the camp of inclusion, you know, which is a camp that people who are non-racist or bigoted and you know, and all of that would naturally want to belong to. But is that really the true identity of that brand? Or is the very human need for inclusion of people living in a diverse society where we have, nearly everyone has people they love or care about or in their family or, you know, friends or whatever, who fits into one of these so-called minority groups, and therefore, you know, inclusion is something that a large proportion of the population wants. And that's become the kind of defining focus of the Clinton brand. And is that truly an accurate characterization of the brand, or is it something that, you know, has been sort of cobbled together from a kind of marketing perspective in order to create a homogenous brand?
Well, I think that the election really has become a sort of referendum on whether you want to have a homogenous identity or a diverse identity.
Mm-hmm.
The homogeneity would be presented by its supporters as, you know, traditionalism and, as they say, making America great again.
Mm-hmm.
Envisioning like this a return to a time when Americans could assume that they had a single identity, because that was all that was presented to us, was an overwhelmingly white Christian male-led society, and the Democratic brand is presented as multi-ethnic, gender egalitarian, accepting of sexual diversity, and welcoming of immigration. I think these issues are what makes it difficult to talk about this election. These issues are real. It's not that these are some kind of facade put in front of the real issues. But there are other issues that are elided by this on both sides. The presentation of the November 8th as a battle between traditional white Christian America and multi-ethnic, more inclusive America, and chief among these, I would say, is our class issues are erased by the presentation of the election as this choice about what kind of inclusive or exclusive community we want to be, and so you have the fact that both of the candidates are extremely wealthy, derive much of their support from billionaires who are bankrolling them, in many ways have policies on both sides of the major party divide, have policies that are based on the assumption that the rich will continue to get richer, and that we will not have any actual changes in the distribution of wealth in our society, despite the fact that we've moved sharply to a more unequal society over the past 40 years. These questions are sort of are left out. They're not put on the agenda. We have looked at the debates as one of the key ways that media show their priorities during the election season. You have the Commission on Presidential Debates. It's often misdescribed as a nonpartisan group, and in fact, it's a bipartisan group. It's the leadership of the Democratic and the leadership of the Republican Party getting together and saying, we're going to organize the debates, and it's a way of keeping third parties out unless they have a truly enormous share of the public opinion as represented by polling, and making sure that the agenda sticks to the agenda that the Democratic and Republican parties are comfortable with, and so they negotiate with major media outlets. Interestingly, in recent decades, it's been overwhelmingly television. The print news, which by its medium does tend to have more depth and complexity than television news, which is in the business of reducing stories to little 3-minute mini mysteries. Television has been the people who have been chosen to represent the American public in these debates since I think 1992, and then the having picked who's going to be the questioners, you can count on them to keep the range of debate in the track that is pre-selected. So you've seen over the four, the three presidential debates and the vice presidential debate, an overwhelming focus on terrorism, as though that were the major threat facing the United States. tremendous focus on Russia as a foreign policy challenge. When the economy comes up, it's generally in the form of questions about taxes, meaning are we raising taxes too much on the wealthy or on debt? You know, are we spending too much on? And it's always the assumption is always that what we're spending too much money on is social services, particularly for the elderly. You know, and this is a you know, a format that, that both the Democratic and Republican parties, which are dominated by wealthy elites, and the stockholders who own the media conglomerates that provide the moderators are very comfortable with. It's not challenging them. If you said, you know, Madam Secretary, what are you going to do about the great rise in inequality that we've seen over the past 40 years? That would, first of all, make a lot of the donors that give money to both the Republican and Democratic Party very uneasy. And it would make the board of directors, who are ultimately the boss of the moderator, antsy as well. They don't want to see inequality or poverty put on the national agenda as something that, that candidates are expected to do something about. They would much rather see, you know, the question of are you going to be raising taxes too high, or are you going to, you know, not cut money for the retirement for elders, as as has been a big project since the 80s, is reducing the amount of money that is spent on our elders' retirement. And the thing that really just jumped out at us as not being talked about, it was not talked about in any of the three debates, the presidential debates or the vice presidential debate, and wasn't asked about in 2012 either. Now we're talking about questions posed by moderators. There's not a single question in either 2012 or 2016 to the presidential candidates, the vice presidential candidates, about climate change. And this is an issue. I mean, if you pay attention to what scientists have been saying over and over again, in a, you know, hair on fire kind of way, we are headed towards a human catastrophe.
Right.
As we alter the climate by burning fossil fuels, as we raise the level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, we are inexorably raising the temperature and disrupting all the climate systems that we depend upon for our food supply primarily. You know, our agricultural systems are based on the climate that we have, not the climate that we will create for ourselves if we keep on doing what we're doing. And, you know, they've been pointing to, you know, a 2% Celsius rise as the limits that they believe that our ecosystems can handle. Some people think that is overly optimistic, that we could adapt to even a 2-degree rise. But to stick to a 2-degree rise means starting to change our economic system now. We need to, the amount of fossil fuels that have already been discovered is already too much. If we burn that, we've gone over the 2%, the 2-degree limit. So every like new oil field that is discovered is oil that we can't burn unless we want catastrophe on our hands. You know, and we need to start acting like this. You know, this is...
Well, that's what the whole DAPL thing is about. I mean, it's about both... It basically
exactly.
is both sides
right.
of this. It's
right.
both a minority issue, and it's the climate change issue really at the base of it. You know, how are we doing? I mean, we basically are, you know, about to vote in, and certainly I'm no fan of Trump at all, but we're about to vote in another round of Democratic leadership when the current leaders are, for example, not taking a stand on this issue, completely ignoring it, demonstrating that they are likely, you know, vested, funded by, or in the pocket of the, you know, the industries that are profiting from this. And, you know, they can't put a check on it. We certainly don't have any reason to feel any more hopeful about what Donald Trump, who's a climate denier, would do. So, you know, we have, in effect, hard climate denial, which is, you know, somebody who is blindly denying the science. And then we have soft denial, which is people, you know, who are good on these other issues of inclusion, you know, like the president and like the current Democratic Party candidate, you know, who, you know, offer lip service, but are really adverse to doing anything substantive, very likely because of their campaign finance supporters. I mean, this is it's kind of the classic gridlock of this election, and there is this hope that the Democratic candidates could be pushed, but there isn't really a terrific track record of that. You know, does the media, you know, is the media ready to, you know, given that the media also, you know, most of the mainstream media has, you know, an agenda or support for one side rather than another, how well are they doing at calling this out so that people are aware of it?
Well, I mean, I think that if you are thinking, you know, people talk about fairness in campaign coverage, about whether mm-hmm. the media are being fair to one candidate or the other candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And it really always strikes us as being kind of beside the point. The point is not mm-hmm. to be fair to the candidates. The
mm-hmm.
point is to be fair to the public.
Mm-hmm.
The public need a discussion of the issues that are facing their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And if you, you know, if you are not providing that, it doesn't matter whether you are treating the Democrat or the Republican fairly. And
mm-hmm.
I think that climate change and DAPL as a symbol of the struggle to turn around, you know, the ship headed towards the iceberg, is really emblematic. You know, the fact that that this story is a dramatic story.
Mm-hmm.
There are you know, there are clashes of, you know, it's a visual story of, you know, people
mm-hmm.
on the prairies. I mean, it really draws from the visual language that goes very deep in American culture of, you know, the people on the prairies, on the horses, and the, you know, up against the very militarized security forces. It's a story that you know, from a if you thought that media were just trying to get ratings.
Mm-hmm.
If that was all that news was about, you
mm-hmm.
think this would be a great story to draw people's attention. There's a lot of human interest here,
mm-hmm.
And yet this is a story that you know, if there had been an order from the government saying don't cover this story, you wouldn't have seen much less coverage of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why this story that represents an issue that could not be more important is not leading the nightly news every night, I think is a real indictment of the priorities of the news judgment of the people who are deciding what is on our agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And the lack of questions at the debate is the flip side of that. You know, you've got on the one hand the actual popular struggle against planet destroying extractive energy production, and on the other hand, here you have the people who are vying to become leaders of the free world, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't ask them, like, what is your plan
mm-hmm.
for stopping this disaster that scientists agree is coming if we don't do something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And when you're talking about hard denial and soft denial, I think that's very right. The hard denial is saying, we don't need to do anything about climate change because it's not happening, or we're not
mm-hmm.
doing it, you know,
mm-hmm.
or it won't be any big deal. And then the other side is saying, you know, yes, we should do something about it, and acting like that acknowledgement is
mm-hmm.
sufficient.
Right.
You know, that it's like a cultural thing. Like
mm-hmm.
You see people say, I believe in science. You see Hillary Clinton say, I believe in science.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, you're supposed to say, yeah, me too. I'm the kind of person who believes in science.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all believe that what we are doing is fueling the destruction of our ecosystem, and not doing anything about it. Which is a very strange form of science, I'd say.
Well, there's a big disconnect there, obviously. And the media is part of the disconnect. Because one of the things that I've noted is there's no follow-up. The other problem is that, there's come to be, I obviously, covering these environmental stories, I cover climate. I mean, that's the... contamination, pollution of water supplies and climate are really the reason, that I've been covering fracking pipelines and all the rest of it. But, you know, what happens is, and I remember very early on one time at a press conference, President Obama said the word climate in a State of Union address, and, 350.org and everyone are going, oh, he said climate. Now we have since December of 2015, we have the Paris agreements, and it was like, now we've set a benchmark. Yay, hooray, now someone else signed on. The fact that we've already surpassed those benchmarks, that these benchmarks are not being... they're not enforceable, they're voluntary, whereas the trade agreements that we sign, which will take down environmental benchmarks and regulations globally to allow a further expansion of all of these extractive technologies and pipelines and exports and all the rest of it, which are, of which the DAPL is kind of the current strongest, most powerful, visible example, is completely ignored. And instead, for example, you get these parsed statements. Hillary Clinton says, yes, we, have to look at fracking and, maybe it's bad. And then later she says we have to look at this pipeline, but we also have to think about the workers. That's a parsed statement. You're basically talking to two sides that hold, different agendas about this. And that's not called taking a stand. That's called creating a homogenized brand with a contradictory stance at its very heart. And if there were anything that the media should be doing, it would be unpacking that stance rather than, just kind of passing it along. And then each side of this contradiction hears what they want to hear. The people who want to hear, we need this for jobs, they hear that. And the people, who want to hear climate, they hear that. But the fact that these two have not been reconciled, there's no pathway to reconciling them at all, actually, scientifically or in any other way, is kind of ignored. And so then everyone says, well, we'll push from our side. And then, you basically have a recipe for future conflict and division that's incorporated in the kinds of double-sided statements that, you know, with marketing teams in place, presidents and elected officials and candidates make, and people really lack the tools for digesting what they're hearing when they want to feel hopeful. And it really is the role of the press to do that unpacking and analysis and digestion for people. But the press isn't doing it. Is the reason the media ownership? Is it really that, you know, is that the reason? Why did they promote Trump, for example? Everyone says, oh, it's for ratings. You know, he's so good on television, they couldn't help themselves. They don't care about the political outcome. Is it that they don't care, or is it that, you know, they kind of fomented the horse race because of certain agendas that perhaps we're ignorant about and can't openly state, apart from some recent WikiLeaks? I mean, you know, what's going on there when they don't unpack it, when they don't do the job, when the people are left in so much confusion around this?
Right. It's a big mistake to think that the people who control the most powerful opinion-shaping institutions in our society don't care about that power. Of course they care about that power. That's a big part of why you own a TV network or a newspaper like the New York Times or the Washington Post, is because of the power that they give you.
Mm-hmm.
The two-party system is very powerful because it provides you with two options that either, in general, either option is broadly acceptable to the powers that be.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a real fight with real issues between the parties. You know, it's not, I think it's a mistake to think of the parties as being identical. In many ways, they're very different and represent different coalitions, both different coalitions of voters and different coalitions of elites behind them. You know, the people who are providing the money for the parties are not the same people. They're not the same industries, and that reflects. You know, that can be seen in the policies that they that the two parties prefer. In the case of Trump, in 2015, when the Trump juggernaut was getting going, you really saw a huge amount of coverage, an unprecedented amount of coverage from television, giving a gigantic and very valuable platform to Donald Trump. And in part it was Trump comes out of reality television. So he knows what to do. He knows the role that he's supposed to play. And in the same way that, you know, The Apprentice is based on creating tensions and feuds and manufactured drama, the Republican primary became a story of tensions and feuds and manufactured drama with Donald Trump as the star.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no wonder that he came out on top, because the protagonist of the story always makes it to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And it was it's hugely lucrative for the networks, and this is I don't think that if you polled the board members of the TV networks, you'd find very few Trump supporters. You'd find a lot more Clinton supporters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to say that they, you know, in a normal year, you would find a lot more support for the Republican candidate. Mm-hmm. And there is a way in which Donald Trump is not quite in the circle of acceptable opinion, and it's not really so much his policies as he sort of rejects the institutional structure that politicians and journalists in our country are embedded in. And mm-hmm. that's what is appealing about him to a lot of his supporters. It's why Donald Trump has gotten almost zero endorsements from newspapers in this election cycle. That's not mm-hmm. normal. Mm-hmm. It's normal for Republicans to get more newspaper endorsements than Democrats. That's what happens in a normal year.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about what was revealed in the WikiLeaks that the Clinton side had a strategy for there to be the nomination of the so-called Pied Piper candidate, which they identified three, and that given the extensive press contacts and influence that is all over the WikiLeaks emails to John Podesta, Clinton's campaign manager, do you think that possibly, in some ways, Trump was an ideal buffer to make, you know, that in the end made Clinton look good or better than she might have looked had there been a more traditional Republican candidate?
Yeah, though, it's a double-edged sword in that Trump is willing to play on populist themes that, Jeb Bush would not be able to play on. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that trade is one of the things that really unites the capitalist class in this country.
Mm-hmm.
No, that hasn't always been the case. Mm-hmm. Where you used to have a lot of industries that were hurt by trade and were looking to, you know, they would support candidates who like protectionist measures.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I think you could still find niches here and there, but by and large, I think the anti-trade capitalists lost and have, you know, the companies that used to depend on domestic manufacturing now are outsourcing their manufacturing to other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have a real base in the elite for the kind of questioning of like TPP that Donald Trump does.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of why he has no newspaper endorsements. It's also part of why he is getting such enthusiastic support from people who feel like they have been left out of the economy, because they have.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Trump's trade analysis, it doesn't go very deep. You know, it's sort of a, like, you know, Mexico's stealing our jobs, China's stealing our jobs, you know, and these trade deals are not about the United States versus Mexico or the United States versus China. These trade deals are about economic elites around the world figuring out ways to make trade work for the elite and against the working people on all sides of the borders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, NAFTA was not, you know, Mexico's stealing our jobs. NAFTA was a way to get wages reduced in Mexico and wages reduced in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
By putting the workforces in more direct competition with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump, even though he is questioning TPP will not frame it as an issue of corporate power, which I think is what it essentially is.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though he goes too far for the stockholding class to really say, yeah, he's our guy.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't go so far that they are worried about him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Les Moonves famously was talking about how great Donald Trump was for CBS. He's the CEO.
Mm-hmm. I remember that, yeah, with the ratings. Yeah, that's what I was referencing in the question.
And the fact that the people trying to stop Trump were spending so much money on television advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that, to always keep in mind when you're thinking about election coverage, is that it's a huge business for the television networks in particular. They really mm-hmm. make a lot of their money from these TV ads. It's a situation where television advertising has a certain level, in normal times, and then when election time comes, you have people with pouring money into advertising. That's the main way that campaigns are conducted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all money in the bank for the TV networks.
Mm-hmm.
And it factors into their economic planning and, how their business model really relies on. So if you had like campaign finance reform, effective campaign finance reform would have to depend on free television. To take money out of the campaign, you have to give campaigns away.
We're going to have to close the show now. Just want to, thank you. I've been so fascinated. I didn't signal that as I usually do, but thank you so much. Jim Narakis of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting for being with me today discussing the media and the elections. And thank you, listeners, for being with us on this week's edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, Progressive Radio Network, the day after the election. So make sure to come back and tune in and share this show with others who would enjoy it. Have a great week. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Mahuwe.